Everybody have a great weekend and stay left of bang.
Yeah.
17 years, we have launched our fair share of online courses, coaching programs, and finding the right platform has always been a challenge.
They say if you do what you love, you never work a day in your life. But if you're an entrepreneur, you know the hard work that comes with it. That's why you need Kajabi. Kajabi makes it easy to run your entire online business from one platform so you can focus on what you love, creating.
Kajabi is the ultimate all-in-one platform that helps creators and entrepreneurs build successful online businesses by unlocking predictable recurring revenue.
No matter your niche, Kajabi makes it easy to turn your skills, passions, and experiences into enriching online courses, exclusive membership sites, subscription podcasts, thriving communities, personalized coaching, and more.
The best part? Kajabi doesn't cut into your revenue because everything is owned and controlled by you. So keep 100% of what you earn.
And with Kajabi, you also get robust analytics, easy payment options, email marketing tools, and customizable website templates, all built in.
You don't even need a huge audience to make sustainable income. There are thousands of creators on Kajabi making six and seven figures with less than 50,000 followers.
Right now, Kajabi is offering a free 30-day trial to start your business if you go to kajabi.com/charm. That's KAJABI.com/charm.
Go to kajabi.com/charm and join the creators and entrepreneurs who have made over $7 billion.
Hey, Art of Charm listeners, I'm excited to share a new podcast I've been absolutely binging. Winning is an everyday mindset, and Craig Robinson and John Calipari are here to help. On Ways to Win podcast, Craig and Coach Cal use their on-court wisdom to solve your off-court problems. Whether it's trouble at home or a workplace dilemma, the coaches will help you find a winning formula for success. You'll hear from prominent athletes, business leaders, and celebrities who reveal insights that made them into the leaders they are today. And don't miss President Obama sharing how he deals with pressure by projecting confidence, believing in your team, and taking criticism. Listen to Ways to Win wherever you get your podcasts.
This is the Art of Charm. Learn everything you need to know to crush it in business, love, and life. The Art of Charm is where ordinary guys become extraordinary men.
Welcome to The Art of Charm. I'm Jordan Harbinger. The Art of Charm brings together the best thought leaders, teachers, and personalities to teach you how to crush it in life, love, and at work. Imagine having a mix of experienced mentors teaching you their expertise and packing decades of research, testing, and tough lessons into a curriculum. We've created one of the premier lifestyle shows that brings you tools previously only available to elite high performers. We may not have all the answers, but we do have a lot of the questions. Make sure to stay up to date with The Art of Charm and get some great free content that we don't or can't share on the show by signing up for the newsletter at theartofcharm.com. And if you like what you hear on the show, come hang out with us on the blog where we get really in-depth on some of these topics and you can further engage with the Art of Charm team there as well. Or if you're new to the show and you want to find out more about what we teach here at The Art of Charm, you can go to the website and we'll email you our fundamentals toolkit that covers topics like body language, nonverbal communication, dating, attraction, persuasion, business networking and negotiation, relationship management, public speaking, and a whole lot more. And we've got our live programs running every single week here in Los Angeles, California. In fact, we've got guys here from all over the world. So though, no matter where you are, you can make it here if you want to learn and grow. So I don't want to hear from you guys, oh, if you were only in Boise, Idaho, I'd go. We're sold out 5 to 6 months in advance, by the way, so if you're even thinking about it a little bit, you should get in touch ASAP by phone, or you can email me, jordan@theartofcharm.com. Get info from us now so you can plan ahead. Looking forward to meeting you here at AOC. Today we're talking with Patrick Van Horn. He wrote a book called Left of Bang, and he's the founder and CEO of the CP Journal. He's a former Marine, and now he teaches people, police, Marines, and civilians, how to identify threats using nonverbal communication and other types of really cool little techniques to profile people, although everyone hates that word. But it's the good kind of profiling, the effective kind that's not based on the color of your skin. So I think you guys will enjoy this. We're going to talk about how to establish baselines in people, what to look for in people who are threatening, how to make a decision whether someone is threatening, and how to practice and master this process. And as a treat, producer Jason is in studio to help me ask some of the tough questions, or the questions I just wouldn't have thought of on my own. So enjoy this one with Patrick Van Horn. Tell us what you do in one sentence.
My company teaches people how to ensure their own safety.
By teaching them nonverbal communications and stuff like that.
Yeah.
Okay. Reading nonverbal communication. So a half sentence. That's the best anyone's ever done. Yeah. Thanks.
So what the Marine Corps calls what we do is combat profiling.
Ah, yeah.
And so when I was getting out of the Marines and starting the company, our first website was combatprofiling.com.
Okay.
And we were going after some police departments as our first clients. And it turns out that there are no two words that can turn off a law enforcement client more quickly
than profiling.
Profiling or combat tactics.
Yeah. How about you should just name it racist combat profiling.
It was our first business lesson learned, like, okay, that's a showstopper for our major market. So we are going to adjust. And so technically, it ties back to where we first learned how to do this and we first learned the concepts, and that was in the Marine Corps Combat Hunter program.
It's funny you had that problem because, you know, we're called the Art of Charm, which I thought, like, this is like a very innocuous thing to call yourself because everybody loves charming people. And now that we have this really massive wide audience, I get the occasional email, usually from a guy who's like, you know, the whole thing with charm just sounds manipulative. And I'm like, well, we can't work around everyone's emotional issues when it comes to these topics. But it does strike some people negatively. And my friend Ramit Sethi, he runs a business called I Will Teach You to Be Rich, but it's not scammy. It's not even about finance anymore. And it's his one of his big sort of, not regrets, but sort of maybe I would have done things differently moments is he goes, I don't know if I would have branded that way knowing that we were going to evolve into what we are now. And mm-hmm. I totally get that because combat profiling sounds awesome. But, you know, apropos all of the stuff that's going on with racial profiling and then police being too warrior like, mm-hmm. you've got this mix of like, oh, we don't want anything like that, and we certainly don't want to get audited, and then you're on 2020 like, no, we hired combat profiling, but it has nothing to do with combat or profiling, so just calm down, everyone.
And it's funny how the Marines got to the name. They looked at the class and go, if we call this behavior pattern recognition and analysis, no one will ever show up for this class,
right?
We call it combat profiling. Go, oh, that sounds cool.
That sounds awesome. But also because I'm a huge nerd and so is Jason. I don't know if Marines are going to be like, yeah, I'm signing up for that. Yeah. Especially if because personally, I don't know if I can spell that whole thing without looking at the dictionary. So I don't know how successful that would be either. Because speaking of branding, our first name for Art of Charm 8 years ago was Charismatic Lifestyle. My mom goes, who's not in business at all, she's a friggin' retired public school teacher, goes, can you spell that without looking at anything? And I was like, no, and that's probably your fault somehow, but you're right, I'm going to change the name. So
it's funny, the CP Journal is our DBA. So we start like combatprofiling.com turned into CP Journal because at first, the only goal was to provide articles and pictures and videos for students to come who came through our class just a follow-up resource. My technical company name is Active Analysis Consulting. So my first email address was patrick.vanhorn@activeanalysisconsulting.com.
Oh,
it turns out there's like 1% of the population that can spell analysis and consulting right at the same time.
Right.
And so we lost a huge contract. Someone thought we blew them off and they spelled analysis wrong.
Oh, man.
So, yeah. So I never got the email.
Oh, that's too bad. Well, yeah, business lesson learned. But
oh, absolutely.
Tell us how you got into all of this because, you know, you served in the Marine Corps, of course, for 7 years. You became a captain and then you went, wow, I really like a lot of the stuff I'm doing here, but what, I don't want to stay in the service or you couldn't stay in the service? How did that pan out?
Well, the way the Marines work is you spend, during my 7 years, we spent the first 4 years in a deployable unit. And then after a certain number of deployments or time, they rotate you to a non-deployable unit just to kind of give you some time at home, you know, spend some time with the family. And I got rotated into what the Marine Corps calls training command. And I was brought into this program called Combat Hunter to be an instructor. And as we're doing this training, we used to get a lot of reserve police officers, a lot of LAPD. I was stationed down in Camp Pendleton outside of San Diego. And we would get these reserve Marines who were police officers in their day job who would come through our course before they deployed. And I'd always ask them, you know, hey, based on your life experience, you know, what do you like about this course? What do you think works? What do you think doesn't work? They had a little different experience than the typical 18 to 22 year old Marine we were teaching. And they always kept saying the same thing that, hey, this is great. I'm glad I have this before I go to Afghanistan. But I'm working 4 or 5 days a week in my day job in Southeast LA in these gang control neighborhoods. And we don't have anything even close to this. And so after hearing it enough times, I saw the opportunity that, hey, there is an opportunity to do this training to a civilian market outside of the military. And it's what ultimately led us to write the book and then start the company and build the training program. So it's not just the military, but we do training for police departments, security companies, universities, anyone, corporations, anyone who is trying to focus and concerned about preventing violence instead of the kind of typical norms right now, just wait for it to happen and then respond. Wait for someone to open fire, call the police. Wait for, you know, someone to kick down their boss's door, call security. And so it's all based on prevention.
So when you're talking about civilian training, do you count the police as part of the civilian population?
I do.
Okay.
You know, and we kind of distinguish in there, but it comes down to authority. Whereas the military is working off of rules of engagement and we are able to call people enemies, police aren't looking at, you know, in theory, police, they shouldn't be looking at American citizens as the enemy. And so we make sure that we tailor everything back into fitting into constitutional law and, you know, really how they make decisions on their job. And so it's really the use and the application of the observations, which is how, you know, when it comes to how we distinguish what gets taught and how we package it for that audience.
This is interesting because I actually have gotten many emails and even a testimonial from some gang squad guys down in like Long Beach and other parts of the United States who use Art of Charm concepts like body language, vocal tonality, eye contact to generate rapport with confidential informants, gang members, things like that. They also use it to, they sort of use some of those same principles to go, okay, we can spot aggression or potential aggression or hostility in people, but you actually hone it down and teach just the spotting of hostility and the potential threats among civilian population, correct?
Yeah, and it's what we really try to do is define it very specifically. So we define, so when we talk about how we look and how we assess an individual person, there's only 4 ways that you can assess them. They're either dominant, submissive, uncomfortable, or comfortable. And so we define very specifically what goes into that so that you can take an experienced veteran police officer who is doing this naturally and doing this intuitively because they have 10, 15 years on the job and they've seen all these cues. But our goal is also to take that brand new police officer and give them very specific things that they are looking for so that we can shorten that learning curve and they can become not only capable earlier in their career, but also have the terminology and the language to articulate what attracted their attention to someone in the first place.
Got it. Okay. Interesting. The dumb question, but the one I always ask, why is this important? It seems obvious in this case, but I would love to hear your take on this because you might have some statistics or things like anecdotal evidence that might back up the fact that this stuff is life-saving.
You know, a lot of it comes back down to my experiences overseas as a Marine. You know, there's somewhere between, depending on the research, depending on the study that you believe to be accurate, somewhere between 60 and 90% of all communications nonverbal. There's times when it's 100%. All communications nonverbal. If you're making a decision in the absence of 60 to 90% of everything that you could gather about a situation or about a person, are you really making an informed judgment? Are you actually making an informed decision? And so when we look at what originally came from the military for how are we determining who is the insurgent, who do we need to pay attention to, whose house do we have to go into, who do we have to talk to? If you're ignoring over 50% of everything that's available to you, how accurate are our decisions actually being made? Are we talking to the wrong people? Have we missed the people we should be looking for simply by ignorance or looking at a process that was too complex? And so when we look at the behaviors, by defining it down very specifically, for instance, you know, how we assess an individual person, dominant, submissive, uncomfortable, comfortable, just really trying to make those intelligent and informed decisions, but not only ensuring our own safety, but also just how we operate, how we go about our job.
And this really seemed to be very important for the Marines in the war after the Army basically got rid of their uniforms and you didn't know who to shoot. So you had to kind of figure out by, you know, just assessing the crowd, who was the enemy. Isn't that kind of how this came about?
Absolutely. And it was kind of a more stereotypical example. But when Saddam's regime fell and the Iraqi army got disbanded and the insurgents learned very quickly, if you want to defeat the Americans' technological and equipment advantage that we have. All you have to do is take off your uniform. All you have to do is dress like everyone else. And if we can avoid detection, then they could choose the time and place of their attacks. And really, for Marines and soldiers, we became very reactive. We would not have that advance warning that there was an attack planned or we were going to be in a situation where we had to be ready to fight. And we started to become very reactive. We would wait to get shot at, or we would wait for an IED, a roadside bomb, to detonate. And then once that happened, then we finally knew who out there was trying to hurt us, trying to kill us. We became very reactive. And so when we looked at how we could become proactive, using terminology, how we could get left to bang, it was, how are we looking at that marketplace? How are we looking at the people to realize that, yes, there's a change here that we should be aware of, or this is a person that is not going about or not in this location for a normal reason, that we need to go have a conversation with them. We need to figure out what's going on.
Left of bang is obviously a military term that, is it, that I'm not familiar with? What is it?
It originated in the military, I think, but it's oftentimes, it's becoming, I guess, more commonplace, especially in military and police and security. But we also talk to some of our corporate clients who use it in terms of sales. And all the phrase means is, if you were to think about what bang is whatever event you don't want to happen. In the context of safety, it's the shooting, the stabbing, a bombing, whatever it is that we don't want to happen. In business, oftentimes it's hiring the wrong job candidate, trying to close on a prospect too soon in the process, or pushing too hard or too early. It's whatever event you don't want to happen. When you are left of bang, it means that you've put bang onto a timeline. Bang is time zero. And so being left of bang means we're operating earlier on that timeline. You've identified some of those pre-event indicators that exist, and that the warnings that we could have identified had we been looking for them, to realize that this is about to go bad.
Got it. Thank you. That's cool. I figured, is this a timeline? But why are you left? Shouldn't you be after it? But the point is, you avoid it.
Yeah, the goal is prevention. How can we keep it from ever happening?
Right. The right of bang. Then you're reacting instead of preventing. Okay, I get it.
Absolutely.
Okay, cool. I'm totally going to use that. That's rad.
We find some of our, especially our corporate clients, once we kind of explain the phrase, they absolutely love it, and they use it sometimes incorrectly, but
yeah,
oftentimes we'll see an email coming back to us. So it always cracks us up, or also at the same time happy that
right.
The terminology is working its way into the process.
Everybody have a great weekend and stay left of bang.
Yeah.
I was left of Jordan.
He was left of Jordan, yeah. Why did the Marines create the program in the first place? Is this something that's been around the whole time, or is it just like, wait a minute, now that people are taking off their uniforms, we need to figure this out in a totally different way, because we can no longer say Soviet tanks are amassing on the Eastern Front, everybody pay attention?
It's pretty recent, especially when you look at the grand scheme of military training. It was only created in 2007, and it was really created in response to the situations we were facing. And we were very well prepared for conventional military, and when we can use our technology and equipment to identify where the enemy is and where they're located, it was really just in response to these situations where we at the time thought we had to wait to be attacked. Before Combat Hunter was created, as the insurgency in Iraq was growing, the response from Congress and some higher leaders to it was almost an assumption that we couldn't prevent it from happening. So they put more body armor on Marines and soldiers, put more armor on all of our vehicles, required more Marines and soldiers to be present on every patrol, just in case something went wrong. The assumption was that if we can't prevent it, our goal is to really just survive the shot so that we're capable of responding once they have let us know where they are.
That's so awful.
Yeah. And so in 2007, luckily, some people higher up in the food chain realized that's probably not the best long-term strategy for success to wait to get shot at. And it was Marine General James Mattis, who's just was the Marine Corps' Leonidas, just an absolute badass warrior, who said, all right, we have to find a better way to do it. And he's the one who directed the creation of the program.
That's superb. And so the program, to be super clear, is teaching Marines what to look for and how to look for threats by reading nonverbal cues.
Absolutely.
And that's cool, because we can translate that to civilian stuff. So if people are listening and they're like, whatever, I'm not in the military, we're going to teach you how to look for threats, even if you're not a cop, even if you're not in combat, willingly, or as part of your job anyway, in combat. Like you said in the beginning, sort of pre-show, don't wait till the guy you fired last week comes kicking down your door to figure out, wait a minute, that was not supposed to happen.
And by looking at behavior, I mean, we're always surrounded by people. And so even if you don't want to use this in the context of safety and protection or situational awareness, it applies to the way we have conversations with just everyday people around us, understanding kind of what their current emotional state is and how do we use that to either make ourselves more comfortable in the situation, or how to use it to make the other person more comfortable. So whether it's workplace or safety, that applies to a very wide range of applications.
So you mentioned situational awareness, and Jordan and I both took the Urban Escape and Evasion class a while ago, and we kind of got our situational awareness on. But for like the layperson, how can they kind of use that, and actually what is it and how can they use it in their day-to-day lives?
Sometimes the generic answer to situational awareness is just people not having their face buried in their cell phone, knowing that there's bad things and bad people out there, so that if your head's up looking around, you might identify them sooner. We try to take it a step and a level deeper and really try to get to a level of informed awareness. And really what informed awareness is you know what cues, what indicators that you're looking for, and you have a process out there to proactively see and look for those cues. So it's not just aimlessly looking around hoping you'll find something. By knowing what to look for and how to look for it, we can make it into a repeatable process that we're constantly improving upon. And when it comes down to the what, you know, we'll start to talk about in a little bit some of the behaviors that apply. But when it comes down to how do we look at our surroundings, we teach just a very simple process of you're always establishing a baseline, figuring out what's normal for the people or the situations that you're in. And once you know what's normal, then you can now actively start to look for those things that are not normal, those things that stand out from the baseline.
Now back to the show. Okay, so tell us about the baseline. It seems a little bit self-explanatory, like this is what normal people look like. I mean, is that what that is?
Exactly. And we just try to make it very specific. So when you start looking at individual people, there's certain situations that you'll find yourself in where our baseline is everyone's in the comfortable cluster. Everyone's displaying comfortable cues. And if that's what's normal, then now all we're looking for are people who are either dominant, submissive, or uncomfortable. Anything other than comfortable is going to attract our attention. But there's other situations, take airports oftentimes or hospitals. Oftentimes our baseline in those situations isn't people who are comfortable, it's people who are uncomfortable. They don't want to be in these areas any longer than they have to be. They want to move on. But by defining that in those situations, we're expecting people to be uncomfortable. Now we can turn our search to dominance, submissiveness, and comfort. So in one situation, comfort is what's normal and discomfort is what's going to cause someone to stand out. Mm-hmm. And that can be completely reversed in other situations.
So it's like lie detection, where you're supposed to be nervous in these situations. You're supposed to be calm when someone's asking you your address. But if you're asking where somebody was last week and they were doing something or they're lying about it, there's these little tells.
Yeah, the concepts certainly apply. We don't teach or really focus too much on deception detection, but the same principles apply across both fields.
So when you're talking about like flipping it, most people are uncomfortable and then there's a comfortable person, you know, that's the person that you should be looking at. Because I just think about walking through the Tenderloin here in San Francisco and everybody's generally uncomfortable. And the people that are really comfortable are the ones that are about to shank you in the back and take your wallet.
Right, because they live there and they're ready for action. Yeah, exactly.
Absolutely.
Tenderloin, and for your info, is the worst part of the city in terms of crime and things like that.
I had no idea.
Yeah.
You know, we use the example sometimes of the airport baggage claim where people want to get their bags and get out of there as quickly as possible. They don't want to hang out at that part of the airport any longer than they need to. And so we'll use the example sometimes. If you're a criminal, though, and so while most people are uncomfortable, that criminal could be displaying comfort. If the baggage claim is his preferred hunting ground where he knows he can hang out as long as he needs to identify whatever his, you know, ideal target is. Maybe it's a tourist who is lost in the baggage claim, or parents who are, you know, distracted by misbehaving kids, or a person who doesn't speak English. Whatever their ideal person, ideal target is, they can hang out there and wait simply until that person presents themselves. So while everyone else is trying to get out of the baggage claim, that's the person who might be comfortable simply because they're not in that rush. They don't have that pressing need to get out of there.
Excellent. so we've got our baseline, right? We know that this is how normal people act in this situation, whether it's to be tense or to be relaxed. Because if you look at me in an airport, I look very tense because I'm like, I gotta go to the bathroom. I'm tired. I've got work to do. The internet doesn't even work. My phone's about to die. How am I going to get a ride back? Right. I get that. Whereas, you know, if I look that tense and I'm at Disney World, you know, check the backpack. Right.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
So you're training people to look for the baseline plus what else?
The baseline plus the anomaly. So once you know it's normal, like I said, we just then turn our focus to those things that are not normal. And once you identify that anomaly, that person or that object or the situation that stands out, then you can go forward and actually do something about it to hopefully get left of bang, to provide that you now have that advanced warning that you need to prevent whatever act it was that you were trying to keep from happening in the first place.
What are some anomalies? We've sort of looked at baseline, right? Like, okay, this guy's fidgety and he shouldn't be, or this guy is really, really calm and everyone else is freaking out. That is that ever a thing? Like, if there's like an explosion and there's a calm guy, is that the bomber? Is that what we're talking about? Or is that not, no one's calm when that happens?
Well, that's actually one of the ways the FBI first focused on Dzhokhar Tsarnaev, looking at the...
Is he the Boston bomber?
He was the Boston Marathon bomber, okay. Sorry, yeah. And they were looking at videos and pictures of everyone running away from the finish line. And when one of the agents was a 60 Minutes episode, I believe that covered it, but they just looked at him and they saw comfort and he wasn't panicking and he was just kind of moving on with his day. And from there is how they started to look at other footage and try to track his movement back to the moment before the bombs detonated. And so there are certain situations where, yeah, the person who is calm could attract your attention.
And what are some examples of anomalies then? Just any deviation from the baseline?
It's any deviation from the baseline. And we do that for a reason. And we try to keep it broad and really focus our effort on the baseline because it's what ultimately gives you a capability that you can apply around the world or any situation that you're in. There are other training programs, other books, and other resources that will talk about if you see this behavior, that person should always stand out. Or the same thing, conversations. Oftentimes, they're talking about what we would call the uncomfortable cluster, nervous, anxious, shifty cues. But the problem is if you go to an area where discomfort is what's normal, like that airport, like the hospital, you have a room full of false positives. You have a room full of people that you would assume stand out when in reality, they're all there for the normal, the actual reason why that area exists.
Right, right.
And so it's to create this ability to be adaptable and adjust your approach and adjust your observations based on the situation you're in, not rely on hard and fast rules that may or may not apply anywhere you go in the world.
Excellent.
So you talk about the four pillars of observable behavior. Can you kind of describe what those are?
So when we look at a situation, the first thing that we take a look at is the collective mood, which is essentially the general sense of safety and security that everyone in the area has. And so a mall or a food court or a place like that, everyone is there. Everyone's pretty comfortable because there is a general sense of safety and security. The exact opposite would be that airport where people are trying to get in and get out as quickly as possible. Oftentimes people have a lacking sense of safety or feeling stressed out or frustrated, changing the collective mood. The second pillar of behavior is the way that we assess the environment, essentially whether an area is what we refer to as being a habitual area or an area which is an anchor point. A habitual area is a place where anyone can come or go at any time. There's no restrictions. Think malls and restaurants and beaches and public parks and sidewalks. Anchor points are places that you have to meet some sort of pre-established criteria in order to get into. Now, while many characteristics, let's say, of a restaurant and a bar are exactly the same, the bar is an anchor point because they have that bouncer out front making sure that only people 21 or over can get in. Then we can take a look at the next pillar of behavior, which is group dynamics and relationships. There are really four different ways that we can assess the relationship the members of a group have based on the amount of space that they keep between them. And then there's the way that we assess individual people and whether they are in the dominant, submissive, uncomfortable, or comfortable cluster. And so those four pillars are how we really establish this all-encompassing baseline. It's an area that you're in or a conversation you're having or a business meeting or a person that you're talking to. Some of those elements will contribute to what the baseline is for that situation.
Okay. And the four pillars are, just to clarify, what are those again?
Individuals.
Okay.
Groups, the environment, and the collective mood.
Got it. Okay. Are you observing all of these kind of at the same time and they come together in like this sort of secret sauce that equals decision-making fuel?
Yes. We teach a process as we go through it. You start by looking at the collective mood and you work your way down to the way we assess individuals. And at the end of it, you just have this understanding, this very clearly defined baseline, this very clearly defined normal for the situation that you're in, so that you can then turn to looking for those abnormalities, those anomalies that will stand out.
Can you walk us through this process a little bit? That would be really cool if you can like give us even an example or something that especially if people can apply it.
Absolutely. So think about, we'll use an example that most people can relate to. We use a Starbucks coffee shop.
Yeah, perfect.
You walk in that front door of the Starbucks, one of the first things that you naturally, intuitively observe are the noise level, whether it's confrontational or conversational, the cleanliness, whether it's clean or dirty, whether it's orderly or disorderly. Starbucks oftentimes is clean. There's conversational noises and there's a sense of order. And so you get the feeling that this area has a sense of safety. So our collective mood assessment is that people are going to be comfortable here because people feel safe in a Starbucks. Then we look at the area and say the Starbucks is a habitual area. Anyone can come or go from here. There's no one at the door controlling access. Inside the Starbucks, there's an anchor point. Not only employees, let's say, can get behind the counter, or a vendor or someone who works in that store can get behind the counter. So that area, when you're looking at the people back there, we can make some general assumptions about who they are and their relationship with the store and the people that are there. As we start to now understand that this is a habitual area, we can take a look at the groups of people, look at people in line, start to determine if they are strangers or if they came together. And then we can take a look at individual people. If people here are comfortable, then they fit our baseline. If people are uncomfortable, then it's someone that we want to focus our attention on a little bit further. And so as we walk through the process, we start with this biggest picture view of whether that people in general have a sense of safety, and then work our way down to look at each individual person that's there to figure out if they're there for the same purpose of everyone else's. And that's all just based on the assumption that they're there to buy a cup of coffee, get food, free Wi-Fi, or
right,
anything like that.
So are you going into each of these types of situations going, okay, most people probably do this subconsciously, but you're doing it both subconsciously and with intention. You go in and go, all right, this is a Starbucks. Here's how the mood usually is. Wait, this guy in the corner is not on the same page as everyone else in terms of like, a lot of people would say energy level because they can't articulate it, but you're like, he's moving quicker, he's talking louder or not talking at all, or his eye contact is not normal, he's fidgety, but we're at a coffee shop, what's the deal?
Exactly. And so by making it so explicit, I mean, if you've been in a number of Starbucks throughout your life, you will naturally and intuitively pick up on that guy and go, what is wrong with him? Why is he acting this way?
Right.
We just try to make it more explicit and defined so that if you've never been in a Starbucks before, you can quickly figure out what's normal. And so the reason we talk about that with, you know, going back to the military context is there's certain situations where deploying members of the Army or the Marines or the Navy or Air Force, they can't go to all of these areas they're going to deploy to ahead of time. But the way that we establish a baseline for a coffee shop here in the States, they might have a lot of similarities to a cafe overseas. And so by teaching them to go through the process very definitively here, we can help accelerate them through that process when they're in an area that they've never been to before and they have to make very snap, very quick judgments about who stands out and then be able to explain why that person attracted your attention. Because it's not about race, it's not about religion, it's not about any of those indicators. It's based on these uncontrollable elements of behavior.
Now, since most civilians kind of walk blindly through life and you're teaching people to like be more attentive and look for these clues and cues, is there like certain situations where you should trigger this mentality, or is it like an always on? Should I always be, like when I'm out and going to Starbucks, should I always be looking for somebody? It seems like that would be kind of stressful at one point because you're always looking for something to go wrong.
You're 100% correct. It would be impossible to maintain that level of awareness and expend that at least mental energy to go through the process all the time. But there are probably situations when you walked into a restaurant and you just felt that there was something wrong. You walked into a bar and you just immediately got that bad feeling that there's something going on here. I don't want to hang out. Or you looked at a person in an elevator you were about to get into and went, there's something weird. There's something off about this. I'm not getting in that elevator today. And so by being able to define it, we can just help to sometimes even just articulate and understand why we get that bad feeling from time to time. And the way that we teach the process deliberately, it's designed to mirror and follow along the way we intuitively and naturally make these same assessments and same observations. And so especially when it comes to civilians who are not in the military, who are not in the police, when they get that bad feeling about a situation, it's not random. It's something they can believe in. It's nothing that they should question, because there's really something there, something going on that's attracted their attention. And we can just help make sure that you're confident doing it so that you're not questioning those instincts.
Thanks a lot. Now back to it. What happens is you start to rationalize, oh, this isn't happening, because it's such an abnormal experience that your body goes, this guy's not going to pull out a gun and shoot people. He's not going to stab someone with that knife, even though he's acting a certain way, because it's so outside the realm of your experience, usually, especially if you're a civilian, you're not thinking that that's going to happen. Everything in your mind is like, no, 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 relax, stay calm. This can't be that. But if you have this process sort of intentionally in the back of your mind, you're going, listen, I've been trained to know that this is likely going to result from that. This is not normal. I know this both consciously and academically, this is not normal.
Absolutely. And that's one of the biggest things. Sometimes you see those posters, maybe around train station or airports, see something, say something.
Right, exactly. Because otherwise you see a duffel bag and you go, wow, that looks suspicious. Well, no one else is doing any. It's fine.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And then boom.
When you look at a lot of reports and articles on, you know, workplace violence or school violence, there's almost always the person that says, I saw the person, I realized that there was something wrong, but I wasn't sure, or I didn't want to make the situation worse, so I didn't say anything, I didn't tell anyone.
Right.
And they question that, because going through this process deliberately and with a conscious level of attention isn't something we do very frequently. And so even though they recognize the person, they essentially let the event happen anyways. And so by defining it and making it very explicit, our goal is that we can really just increase that level of confidence so that when you see it, you are confident saying something or calling the police and saying, this is why this person needs to be talked to, or this is why we think something bad is about to happen.
So how do we start to assign people to the dominant, submissive, uncomfortable, comfortable clusters? Can you go over what those are just real quick again? And then how do we sort of plot people on this map in our mind?
Sure. And so those four clusters, and what a cluster is just three or more indicators that you observe on a person that all lead to the same conclusion. You don't want to really rely too heavily on a single posture or gesture or expression, because, you know, you crossing your arms could mean a number of different things. So if we're only relying on one indicator, we run a pretty good risk of being completely wrong in our assessment. So when I say cluster, what we're looking for are three indicators that lead to dominant, submissive, uncomfortable, uncomfortable. When we take a look at where these clusters come from, it's really how we respond to our personal sense of safety and comfort in an area. So when we take a look at the way we will recognize the dominant cluster of cues, what we're really looking for are three indicators that a person displays to make themselves look larger. Think about a person who's about to get in a fight. Their feet are probably spread a little bit more than shoulder width apart. Mm-hmm. Maybe you see people standing with their hands on their hips. Maybe you look at a person who has an angry expression on their face or is gesturing aggressively towards someone that they're talking to.
Right.
When we see people who are trying to control a situation or make themselves look larger, those are the people that we classify as being dominant.
Mm. Okay.
The submissive cluster is the exact opposite. It is the person who's using their body language to make themselves look smaller or avoid confrontation. Sometimes you'll see people when they're sitting kind of roll their shoulders in, feet kind of tuck up underneath their chair, hands maybe in their lap, just doing everything possible to avoid being looked at or avoid being engaged with at all. The uncomfortable cluster is behavior you would probably look at and say they were nervous or anxious or shifty. It might be people who are trying to distance themselves from something as you're talking to a person, and they lean back in their chair or roll their chair to face towards the door. They're showing that they want to get up and leave. People or behavior that you might call what we would call pacifying behavior, things you do when you're nervous and you're trying to calm yourself back down, clenching your hands, rubbing your hands on your pants, rubbing the bridge of your nose, rubbing the back of your neck, something that you probably do that is a calming influence on you. And at the same time, we put blocking type behavior into the uncomfortable cluster when you're not really open or not really interested in what someone has to say. When you look at people with their shoulders raised up or their chin tucked or their arms crossed across their chest, oftentimes those are indicators of the uncomfortable cluster. And finally, because dominant, submissive, and uncomfortable are how we respond to stresses and threats, the comfortable cluster is when there is nothing that's stressing us out, just people who are relaxed and open, and they don't perceive anything that has agitated them. Okay. And so that dominant, submissive, uncomfortable, comfortable is how we look at each individual person around us.
Right. That makes sense. I've seen some video for like police reconstructions of murders and stuff like that, where there's a guy like in a liquor store and he's moving his arm really weird. It's like really energetic, but it's like only his one arm, and these cops walk in, and then suddenly he just like out of nowhere murders the cops. And they're like, how can we prevent this? And it's like, look at the footage. He's so agitated here that his body is like, it's bottled up. You know, like he's moving his arm as this weird sort of outlet. And now I guess police are trained to see whenever anybody's doing that, they're just seconds from getting murderously aggressive. And that's one reason why it looks to civilians like they just went after that guy and he was just talking. But it's like, if you see all of these signs, you're not going to wait for someone to draw on you, right?
Exactly. And so if you think about it, everything our body does, from gestures and postures to heartbeat to sweating, everything our body does is just executing a command that our brain gives it.
Right.
You know, that's our, you know, central command post, if you will. Mm-hmm. And humans, we are naturally lazy. So as soon as our brain makes the decision, I need to fight this person, I need to get out of here, I need to attack this person, our body will naturally start preparing for that. Even if it's still a few seconds or a few minutes away, as soon as we've made that decision about what we are going to do, our body will start preparing. And those cues, as a person shifting from the comfortable to the dominant cluster, the comfortable to the uncomfortable cluster, that can just help an alert observer realize there's something going on here that requires investigation. I'm not going to take my eyes off this person until we figure out why they are responding to the situation in this way.
So I want to talk a little bit about the current situation with law enforcement in the U.S. and kind of the warriorification of the police, and how they've kind of moved to more of an aggressive stance, as we've seen just in the news recently. They've kind of moved on from a guardian aspect to more of a, like an occupying force, and how the stuff that you teach can be used by them to kind of pull back, hopefully, to be more intuitive about the aggressors that they see, instead of just viewing everybody as an aggressor.
Well, in a very simple sense, the actions that police officers are taking right now are based on the way they naturally assess how risky a situation is. In the military, we looked at the way we categorized risk as really the probability or the likelihood of an event occurring multiplied by the severity of the event should it occur. And you multiply those two numbers together and you get an overall risk number that allows you to prioritize how important certain things are. So when you look at how do you make something less risky, oftentimes our focus is on the reaction. How do we reduce how deadly or how lethal or how dangerous the situation is should it occur? So if we're worried about getting shot at, we can put on more body armor, or we can put armor on our vehicles, and it makes the act of being shot at less risky because the bullet might not get through the vehicle or might not get through the bulletproof vest. And so when you look at how we are trying to take something like the risk of a police officer being ambushed, which is an increasing threat, one of the ways that people are looking at that situation is if we act a little bit more aggressively or we try to control the situation, it will be harder for someone to attack us. That's really kind of focusing on the right of bang aspect of risk. How can we ensure our own safety should it occur? And oftentimes, it's the same situation that the Marines faced overseas before Combat Hunter was created. if we keep armoring up and keep making our vehicles look bigger, and if we're more aggressive, it can help us maybe prevent some of those attacks from occurring. But at the same time, it made it harder to do our job of building relationships with the locals so that we could get the intelligence that we needed to actually go after, you know, Al-Qaeda leadership. And so when we look at the way we use behavioral analysis, it's really to help them focus on preventing that act from ever occurring. You know, if we can teach a very specific and deliberate and repeatable way that's based on uncontrollable and universal elements of behavior that have been backed by science, they can confidently focus their efforts and attention on this method to identify those people who stand out from the crowd instead of waiting for the bad event to happen and then trying to improve or protect themselves right at bang.
I guess we're not really a political show. I just kind of wondered what you thought about the sort of warriorification of the police department, especially given that you're sort of training these guys every day. I think it's probably very helpful for them to know this stuff, because the safer they feel, the less they feel they need to like be looking at everybody as an enemy if they can actually tell who the threats are, instead of just going, well, I don't know, the last guy who tried to kill me was Latino, so I guess everybody who looks like that is my enemy now. They can go, wait a minute, all right, I know how to specifically identify actual threats instead of just, like we talked about before, profiling, plain and simple,
mm-hmm.
based on ethnicity or something very arbitrary. If you just profile based on that, you have to do that if you can't tell what a real threat looks like.
And those indicators are completely irrelevant. You know, not every political or religious extremist becomes a terrorist. Not
sure.
Every person who gets fired kicks down their boss's door. Not every kid that gets bullied brings a gun to school. We've seen attacks from every race, every gender, young and old. Looking at those indicators oftentimes keep us focused on trying to prevent the last attack from occurring again.
Yeah.
And because they're not true indicators of a person's intentions. Bringing it back to the law enforcement example, oftentimes situational awareness and judgment and decision-making, oftentimes those are left to kind of something ill-defined or not very tangible, and therefore it's hard to train someone to. And so when we make these behaviors that we're looking for very explicit, we can help that person become confident in their own level, their own ability to realize, yes, this person is someone we need to focus on, or no, these people, even though they're acting a little aggressively, I'm not too worried about them actually conducting an attack because of very specific things. And so we're trying to, with our course, by making it more defined, we can just help that level of confidence, and we can accelerate the learning curve or shorten the learning curve of especially a new officer, a younger officer who hasn't had the chance yet to get 5, 6, 7 years on the job to make those decisions for a reason instead of just because of feel.
Excellent. And one thing that I know you, before we wrap real quick, that you mentioned we can do to get better at this stuff is act like somebody who might be aggressive or how you would envision that person to be and see how you feel. Put yourself in the body/mindset of the aggressor, and you can start to find those subtle details that you can then look for in order to protect yourself from threats. And I think that's pretty brilliant. So basically, to be clear, you're sort of like method acting. What if I were a crazy aggressive, wildly violent person at Starbucks? You don't maybe do it at Starbucks, but you do it and you go, oh, they're going to have this posture. They're going to have this eye contact. They're going to have these sort of motions. And with practice, you can start to spot these guys and girls like a pro. And then you don't have to worry about your stupid prejudices based on too much CNN getting in the way of your judgment.
Absolutely. And you know, even when we teach classes, it's impossible to teach every posture, every gesture, every expression. So by learning how to just act like someone else, when you see a behavior and go, that's weird, I don't know why a person would do that, by that method acting role, by doing it yourself, you go, I would do this when I'm pretty uncomfortable or I'm nervous, or I would do this when I'm getting ready to punch this person in the face, or I would do this when I'm comfortable and relaxed. And so by going through it and acting like that person, you can help start to understand their state of mind and the way they are perceiving their own safety.
Thank you very much, Patrick Van Horn, cp-journal.com. You need a new domain. and we'll have that linked up in the show notes for people who can't spell CP or journal. And thank you very much for your time. It's been very interesting. And hopefully we'll get some email in the next couple of years about how it saved someone.
I certainly hope so. Thanks for having me, Jordan.
Thank you.
I hope everybody enjoyed that one. I think that one was really fun. I love learning about how to read nonverbal communication, what stuff is important, what stuff isn't. It's great for dating and it's great for not getting blown up, shot, killed, etc., or stabbed at Starbucks, as the case may be. So I hope you guys dig that. And his book, Left of Bang, is really interesting as well. And he's got an online course. We'll have that linked up in the show notes that shows you how to read these situations. There's a security one, kind of for civilians like me. There's a police one, I think. And there's a military one for you guys. And this is taught in the Marines, but, you know, hey, it's life-saving. So a refresher course might not, I almost said might not kill you. There's a joke in there somewhere, but we'll link that up in the show notes as well. I hope you guys dug it. The show is a fanarchy. It's run by you. We rely on you to help keep our finger on the pulse. So if you know someone who's a good fit for the show, let me know. I'm Jordan@theartofcharm.com. And if you dug this, don't forget to thank Patrick on Twitter. We'll have that linked in the show notes as well as his resources. And I'm on Twitter. I'm @theartofcharm. You should follow me there and harass me and ask me questions that are awkward. Bootcamp details at theartofcharm.com/bootcamp. Now remember, we're sold out 6 months in advance. So if you're thinking about it, it's in the back of your head. You should get in touch ASAP, get some info, plan ahead. And also on the website is not only the blog with tons of amazing articles, but also our bonus episodes that aren't released in the iTunes feed. For those of you who just can't get enough Art of Charm, subscribe in iTunes, write us a nice review. Special thanks to the Jasons for their help in production / hosting of the Art of Charm podcast. Go ahead and tell your friends, because the greatest compliment you can give us is a referral to someone else, either in person or shared on the web. Now have a great week and leave everything and everyone better than you found them.
Thanks for listening to The Art of Charm. Get more confidence, relationship skills, life hacks, and everything for the extraordinary man at theartofcharmpodcast.com.